At Cool Air Products, we developed AC Smart Seal Quick Shot with professionals in mind. It's the only product on the market that's 3-in-1 with sealant, lubricant, and UV dye all in a single application. It's non-toxic, non-flammable, 100% safe to the touch, eco-friendly, and compatible with all refrigerants. It's a safe solution option, backed by years of R&D, Intertech tested, and has sealed millions of leaks. AC Smart Seal, the professional's choice.
All right, guys, another great podcast on tap for you guys today. We have a great topic, something that a lot of you might be interested in, and a great guest to talk on that topic. Super smart dude, great guy. Before I get into that, I just want to bring something up. You ever walk into a grocery store and notice that there's a ton of refrigerated reach-ins or reach-ins that are for purposes of cooling product, like a reach-in cooler? There are tons of them. There's open display cases. There's closed display cases. You ever think about how all of that's done behind the scenes? I've had conversations with people in the trade that do supermarket refrigeration, but I haven't actually gone in depth the way that this podcast goes in depth on how it's all done. All right. Mario Gomez. Okay. He's the guest. He's got a lot of experience in this part of the trade. So you guys are going to want to listen up and pay attention. You're going to learn a lot from Mario. We're going to do two topics on the podcast because Mario's other expertise is high-rise building chiller plants and heating plants. But we talked about supermarket refrigeration to the point where we never had time. So we're going to have to get Mario back on the podcast again to do a secondary, a follow-up, if you will, on this conversation. But guys, listen up, please. This is going to be a great one. This is the HVAC Know-It-All Podcast. I'm your host, Gary McCready. All right, today's True Tech Tools Minute. You guys that follow me on social media, you've seen the logo I had made up, the Vacuum Police, vacuum rated AF. That's just kind of having some fun with how passionate people are pulling a vacuum these days. You see pictures online of people getting down to 50 microns and whatnot. Now, AccuTools has the True Blue hose out. Okay, there's tons of kits available at True Tech Tools, and a lot of them are on sale right now. So the AccuTools True Blue hose is a PVC hose. Okay, the inside diameter is 3/4 inch, and it pulls 80 times faster than your traditional 1/4 inch hose. You guys got to check them out. Promo code KNOWITALL to save 8% on your purchase. And like always, I'll leave a link in the podcast notes regarding preferred testo pricing. Airflow testing was something I really didn't get into too much coming up as a tech in the trade. Maybe because we got balancers involved if there was any major air distribution issues. Now, I know in the residential land, a lot of techs, they tackle the air distribution issues themselves. This is something I want to get more into, actually. And recently, I received the Testo 417, okay? And I'm going to be doing a demo/review and checking some airflow. Now, it checks airflow and temp. It's a rotating vane anemometer. Okay, and you can use it for checking supply air grills, return air grills. And you can use it, the tool by itself, and you can kind of traverse the grill. Or it comes with a couple of different funnels that you can put right over top of it, so you don't have to do the traverse. And then you can kind of calculate your airflow coming in or out of each grill or diffuser. So I'm going to be testing that out very, very soon. So look for that coming in the near future. I'll be posting it on my YouTube channel and social feeds. I posted a picture of my Yellow Jacket Super Evac manifold just recently. And the debate always when I post it is that gauge on top. Well, it serves no purpose, most people say, but The thing is, yes, it does serve a purpose. The purpose I use it for is this. When I'm pulling a vacuum, there's a little gauge port, quarter inch gauge port at the back, or hose connection at the back of the manifold. Now, I have that hooked up to a hose that is connected to my charging tank. Sorry, guys, I got a bit of a cold, so just bear with me. So as I'm pulling a vacuum, that hose going to the charging tank is under a vacuum. So when I'm done pulling a vacuum, I don't have to take any hoses off, disconnect nothing from the system. I just open my charging tank and allow the refrigerant to flow. The Super Evac manifold has two ball valves. I can ball valve the pump off, okay, the pump side off, and just have the system side open. And I can flow the refrigerant into the system. And that gauge on top will tell me when I'm at a slight positive. Why do I want to know that? Because I want to remove my micron gauge before the pressure in the system gets too high. Some micron gauges can take a lot of positive pressure. Some can only take a little bit. But I want to make certain that I'm taking it off when I'm at a slight positive. That way, I'm ensuring I don't damage it. And I'm ensuring I don't push any contaminants like refrigerant oil back into the micron gauge, because refrigerant oil can actually damage it and cause it to not work properly. Then you got to clean it out, and it becomes a pain in the ass. All right, so that's what I use it for. And I've heard rumors, yes, that you should not charge with your evacuation hoses or your vacuum hoses, because over time it could potentially damage the hose. Now, my thinking is this. I can replace the hose if it becomes damaged. Okay, what I don't want to do is start disconnecting parts of the system, potentially getting air and moisture back in the system. I'd rather just leave it as is under a tight, dry vacuum and let my refrigerant fly. And if I have to replace a hose because potential damage could occur because I'm charging refrigerant through a vacuum hose, then so be it. I'll replace that hose. That's what my company is in place to do. To replace damaged parts. So just keep that in mind. That's my opinion on it. You might have a different one, but that's my opinion. Going forward with refrigeration technology stuff, Viper Wet Rag, guys, it's a superior compound when it comes to protecting reversing valves, TX valves, even dryers, because you don't want to burn the paint off a filter dryer. Because if you do, you're exposing the under the paint there, and that can become corroded and start leaking over time, because that paint is to protect the dryer. So protecting that paint from chipping away while brazing will protect the dryer's longevity, okay, especially if it's outside. So you mold it around to protect the device, and a lot of people say, why not just use a wet rag, like a soaked rag in water? Well, I did a test. A wet rag versus Viper wet rag, and Viper wet rag came out way ahead as far as the amount of heat transfer that happened between the wet rag and the Viper wet rag. There's a video on YouTube I made of it, so you can guys go to my channel, scroll through, and you can check that out. It's called wet rag versus wet rag, or Viper wet rag versus wet rag. Cool Air Products, they posted or they sent me a cool little write-up, article, bulletin, whatever you call it. Because they're trying to break the mold on refrigerant sealants, like internal sealants for refrigeration systems. Now, we've all heard the rumors that internal sealants clog stuff up. Yes, that's because the stuff that you're hearing about is polymer-based. It works off of a chemical reaction. Okay, AC Smart Seal that's made by Cool Air Products is an oil-based product. It's an oil-based sealant. It doesn't work off a chemical reaction. It works off a mechanical action where it actually seals the leak like blood platelets in your body passing by the opening. Okay? It's not the same. It doesn't clog anything up. I've tested it. I did a video on it. I injected it into a bottle of water. Okay? And all it did was separate like oil and water. There's no hard deposits. Nothing. Okay? I've had my Testo gauges on a system with it on there, nothing. I've had the system that I put it in, no clogs, okay, guys? So this is the difference between the sealants. Polymer-based will clog up a system if there's air and moisture present. Oil-based will not. Okay, you got to break that that old thinking, that old way of thinking when it comes to sealants. They're not all made equal, and technology advances through time. Okay, so I hope you guys entered the Field Pulse contest for the sign. It was a pretty cool sign. An accident hasn't taken place in, or whatever it said. It was a pretty cool sign. I wouldn't mind having one for my garage or shop or whatever, if I had a shop. I don't have a shop at the moment, but my garage or even in my van. I could hang it in my van. It's a pretty cool sign. But they also offer their app SimpliSend, which is free invoicing and free estimating 100% all of the time. Okay, and if you want to upgrade the Field Pulse, you get your 14-day free trial. That's paperless billing, invoicing, CRM, fleet management, work orders, you name it. All right, so guys, I got a guest on the phone, and as I told you in the intro, we got Mario. And Mario used to do a lot of rack refrigeration stuff for supermarkets. And I kind of, I know how he feels because my neighbor and one of my friends actually does supermarket refrigeration. And when he's on call, he is never home on the weekends. So you know how that feels, right, Mario?
I very much do, yes.
How you doing tonight, man?
Yeah, it's... I'm good. I'm good. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you could make it on the podcast. Yeah. And sorry, man. I just want to thank you for getting onto the podcast. And it's going to be another good one.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, for sure, man. And from when I talked to you earlier today, the amount of knowledge that you shone upon me in that few minutes was incredible. So I think that we're going to spread that knowledge to the listeners tonight. And well, it might not be tonight when you guys are listening, but it's tonight for me. And what time is it where you are right now, Mario? It's got to be around 5:45, right?
Yeah. It's about 5:40 here in Southern California.
Awesome. Cool. So a little bit about you, I guess, before we get into the meat and potatoes. How we do this with all the guests at their first time on the podcast, just so we can get a feel for the conversation and everybody gets to know who you are. How did you get started out in the trade of HVAC and how did you progress forward to where you're at now?
It's kind of a long story, but I'll try to make it short. My dad kind of stumbled into it. He used to work for a telecommunications company, and he started doing maintenance for them, general maintenance, which led into air conditioning on their telecom remote locations. So at the time, I was still in school, and I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do for a trade. And I had all kinds of ideas. I did a bunch of stuff before this, but he was like, you know, it's a good trade. You should try to get into air conditioning. It pays well. There's a lot to learn. There's a lot of different trades involved in it, and it's rewarding. So I didn't really take his advice for a while. I went and did all the other things I was going to do for a while. But at some point along the line, those things weren't working out too well for me. And I had a friend that also was a friend of my dad's. And he was working for on the construction side for a local air conditioning outfit, and they needed some help. And he was like, "Well, you know, if you'd like, why don't you give it a shot and kind of come up from the bottom, learn air conditioning, and see what you think." And I was willing to make a change at the time. I had kind of spent some summers before this with this family friend, just doing side jobs, side work, putting in systems in residential houses and things like that. And it was interesting. You know, it was grunt work at the time, running duct work and all that. We've all done that. So once I got into the trade, I worked for a pretty small shop, mom and pop shop in Southern California. And they basically, it was like a 60-40 split commercial residential. And pretty much did it all. Did service, did installation, did piping, electrical, plumbing, of course duct work, and then started picking up troubleshooting. So they'd send me out and do troubleshooting work. So I became a service tech, and I just picked it up really quick. So I worked for that place, for that shop, for several years. And then I think I'd been there about 4, 5, 6 years, and then I decided I'd gotten married and I was going to move to Houston. So moved to Houston and worked for a small mom-and-pop outfit in a small town outside Houston for a few years, and realized that I wanted to grow. I didn't want to just keep doing the same thing in residential work and small stuff. So there was a pretty well-respected commercial outfit in Houston, and I turned in a resume with them, and they pretty much gave me an offer right away. And that's what led me into commercial refrigeration and working on market refrigeration and racks. That was probably the best move I ever made.
Sorry, go ahead. I was going to say, so the as I was mentioning in the beginning of the podcast, so my neighbor, he does the supermarket stuff, and when he's on call, he's gone, like literally all weekend. So, and you know how that feels, right? And I think everybody that I've talked to in the supermarket refrigeration part of the trade, it's the same thing. It's not just him or you. It's everybody in supermarket refrigeration, because it's like you have a freezer full of meat or a cooler full of meat, and there could be like what, let's say the value of meat in a freezer. Can there be a couple of million bucks worth of meat in a freezer, for instance? Like that's a lot of money. So if the freezer goes down, I mean, you got to be there right away, or there's tons and tons of money lost, right?
Yeah. Basically, the way I had it explained to me is the difference between air conditioning, at least in non-critical environments, and refrigeration is the difference between comfort and product loss. So we're talking revenue. You're talking money, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
So in air conditioning, you're just keeping people comfortable, but in refrigeration, you're protecting customer product, customer investment, customer value. So product is very important to them. And yes, when you're on standby, you're going to get called out, because it doesn't matter what time of day that freezer goes down. If it's 2 a.m, you're going out there and you're going to get that thing running, and you're not leaving until it's running. It doesn't matter what you have to do. If you have to open a supply house, you're going to get what's necessary, even if it's a new compressor. Call a friend, call someone in your group, and get out there and put that thing in right now, because you got to get it up and running.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to lose product. That's their bread and butter. That's their livelihood. So yeah, product is life when it comes to refrigeration.
So let me ask you this, because I do some critical stuff as well, and luckily some of the newer buildings that have gone up, pharmaceutical wise, that I take care of, they actually put 100% redundancy in all their walk-in boxes. So each walk-in box, freezer or cooler, doesn't matter which one, they put in 100% redundancy, and if one fails, the other one is just set a smidge higher, you know what I mean, as a backup. So at the same time, it'll kick in. It's still within the range that it's supposed to be in the temperature, but someone will get an alarm saying, hey, that's been higher for 2 hours now. I wonder if it's switched over to backup. They call us in and we check it out. So from your experience in the supermarket world, did they put in redundancy, or did they just totally forget or fail to do that, and then they have these emergencies on their hand all the time?
It's not a lapse in the, you know, they're not forgetting to do it. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
It's a cost issue.
Yeah.
They don't put redundancy in markets, and that's plain and simple.
Mm-hmm.
I've been working, you know, I've worked on markets. I'm not currently on markets, but I was on markets for many years, and I've yet to see any market that has redundancy.
Wow.
Zero.
Really,
redundancy.
That's crazy.
That's just the case.
It's crazy when you think about it.
It's an initial cost issue.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's limited space for one thing. So mm-hmm. you have, if you think about equipment locations, have to think about cost. Markets, honestly, refrigeration is a tough business to make money in. Market refrigeration is tough for the contracting to make money, but it's also a tough business for the stores to make money. So they cut their margins pretty tight,
mm-hmm.
Honestly, and they really don't invest in the stores the way that that you would like to see them do.
Yeah.
And I've dealt with low end markets. I've dealt with really high end markets, and a lot of the big box stores that are nationwide, even in Canada, United States. We're talking Target. We're talking Walmarts. I don't know if you guys have Walmarts north of the border, but
oh yeah, tons.
Okay.
Yeah.
Didn't know if you had them in Canada. I know you got Targets up there. I'm pretty sure.
We actually had Target, and then they pulled out. We had Target for a couple years, and they pulled out of Canada. They weren't doing well.
I remember reading at that now. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what your big box stores are there, but yeah, they pretty much. I don't understand. I do understand it. That I know it's a cost issue, but no, there's no redundancy. So it would be great, but then it would reduce the need for us as much. So yeah. It's a double-edged sword. We oftentimes complain about out at all hours till 1, 2, 3 in the morning, working 60, 70 hour weeks. But at the same time, if they had all these, if they had all this redundancy in place, they'd probably need us a lot less. And some of the guys would be like, hey, I like my overtime.
Yeah,
so, exactly. I guess you can't make everybody happy all the time.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. Let's say we walk into a machine room or a mechanical room, and like, what are we going to expect to see in rack refrigeration? Like, take us through that as a visual. So guys that haven't been in one of these rooms and seen this stuff, let's mm-hmm. be our eyes for a minute and then walk us through into the mechanical room and what we're going to see in that room.
Okay. Well, a lot of it has to do with the geographic region you're in as to what kind of climate you have.
Okay.
So for instance, right now I'm in Southern California. So, we have a rather relatively dry climate. And I used to live in Houston, along the Gulf Coast of the United States, and that has a relatively humid climate. So in more humid climates, you're going to have your condensers usually somewhere outside the building, on the roof, along the edges of the actual building.
Mm-hmm.
But in Southern California, because of the dry climate, or this might be what you consider like a desert climate, they use what we call evaporative condensers. And they're usually in the actual motor room with the compressor racks.
Wow, I didn't know that.
So your condenser, yeah, and it's pretty common in Southern California to locate them in the same room with the racks. One of the benefits of that is the room itself will have two hoods. Well, it will have a makeup air hood, and then the evaporator condenser actually draws air from the actual mechanical room. So the room is self-cooling. So it actually draws ambient outside air, draws it across the racks, and then uses that air to do the condensing and discharge through usually a hole in the ceiling, in the roof of the room, which is watertight, and then mm-hmm. it discharges it out. So you get a good cooling effect in that room. So Southern California, the mechanical rooms for rack refrigeration tend to run cooler, which is a good thing. But when you enter those rooms, they're very noisy because you usually have, depending on the size of the store, two or three parallel racks. And what these racks are is they're basically just a very large version of a typical refrigeration circuit or air conditioning circuit. On this rack, you're going to have several compressors. They're all going to be tied to a common discharge manifold. They're going to have a common suction manifold, all of the compressors tied to it. And they're all going to be piped over on the discharge side to wherever the condenser, whether it's on the roof or whether it's in the same room. And then they're going to come back from the condenser on the drop leg to your receiver. And then from there, the receiver distributes the liquid back onto a manifold on the rack, which is your liquid line manifold. And then all your branch circuits are on the rack generally. And they're all distributed with solenoids off to the different locations of the store, to the different cases or the different walk-ins, depending. So it's a complex machine. It's got a lot of moving parts. It's got a lot of piping. And at first glance, it can be intimidating because there's a lot of things that until you really sit there and look at it for a while, you may not understand what it's trying to do. But really, it's no different than any other air conditioning or refrigeration system you've worked on, as far as the concept, the theory, what it's performing. It's just the amount of different circuits can be confusing. So
yeah, exactly.
So you're going to find that. You're going to find these different racks, and they're going to have different racks for different reasons. Because in a store, you're going to have cases running at different temperatures. So you're going to have your medium temp, you're going to have your low temp. And in some stores, you may even have a high temp, which is what we call air conditioning, is actually high temp. And some of the racks actually perform the air conditioning part for the store itself. So that's what you're going to find. You're going to find those in the mechanical room. They're all going to be lined up in order. And generally, each rack is going to be run by some type of computer control system.
And then you're going to have an operator's type computer where you can read all all this information on, right?
Yeah. That's the control system, what we call the EMS or the BEC or whatever you want to call it, the BAC, Building Automation Control. There's a lot of different manufacturers.
Oh yeah, tons. Sure.
Maybe
yeah.
some of the people listening to this might recognize some of them. There's Danfoss. There's CPC. There's Micro Thermo. There's RMC. There's RDM. There's a lot of different brands. A lot of different makes. There's some really old ones too. Trying to remember some of the names of them, but there's many different controllers out there. But basically, the same theory behind each one is input-output boards, sensors, taking in information, processing it, and then relay outputs, opening and closing things, opening and closing valves, opening and closing solenoids, all things things like that, all performing different functions. And of course, all the information is being relayed back to the controller, set points, and it's automatically controlling everything.
Yeah, and then basically, it can you program alarms into these things, and like we have some control stuff out there, and we have them programmed to email whoever is in charge of that building that hey, something's wrong. So do you guys do the same thing? Program them to email out alerts to the store manager or whatever?
Yeah, what we found is a lot of the stores hire a third party monitoring system or a company.
Okay.
And so these controllers are basically tied in through Ethernet or landline or somehow so that the external monitoring company can basically see the mirrored outputs or whatever the values these boards have on them. Or I'm sorry, not the boards, the controllers. And so they can see what's going on. So if there's any alarms come up, they're automatically aware of them. And that's how a lot of the service calls are generated.
Mm-hmm.
Basically there's alarm set points. If suction pressures get too high, if head pressures get too high, if cases get out of temperature, basically things like that, then yeah, they'll go into alarm, and either they will send an alarm to somebody, generally whoever the building administrators are, or to the monitoring companies, and then that's how calls are generated.
Yeah, exactly. But cool.
The computer control system is very critical to the operation of the rack and keeping things running smoothly. So there's a lot to it. There's a lot to how the rack runs and why it runs the way it does. I'm not sure exactly what all you want to know about that, because I could give you all the details.
I do have a few questions. So typically on average, like how many compressors are you going to see on a given rack, and what kind of tonnage would they go up to in your experience?
Basically a rack is usually sized not by tonnage, but it's sized by one of two things: horsepower,
okay,
or CFM value. So let's say, for instance, a rack, a typical rack is going to have between 4 to 8 compressors, depending on how much of the store it's serving.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have a medium temp rack, and generally most of your store is going to be medium temp. Your low temp is going to be your freezers, your frozen cases. Like in most stores, in the center of the store, you're going to have your glass door frozen cases. You might have some frozen cases or some frozen food walk-ins in the back of the vault, the ice cream vault. Maybe in your deli, you have a frozen deli, or not frozen deli, but a bakery freezer. There's other freezers, but generally the low temp is the minority and the medium temp is the majority. Medium temp is going to be your produce, your deli, your red meat, your dairy, things like that. And so that constitutes the majority, but the medium temp racks are going to be larger. So they're going to have more compressors. Most racks consist of anywhere from 15 to 30 horsepower compressors. You're probably going to have you're going to have two or three on the larger side, maybe 25 horse to 30 horse. You're probably going to have the bulk of them be smaller horsepower, 20 and 15 horsepower or smaller. You may have, depending on how the rack is controlled, a couple of those compressors may have unloaders on them. And the purpose of that is really the way the rack works is, especially with the EMS system, is that you want to maintain a certain suction set point. And generally, as we all know, and if we don't, we might want to recall, that pressure and temperature have a direct relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so we want to make sure that in refrigeration, we're really paying close attention to temperature, not so much pressure. Of course, we want to know that. But when we make our decisions in refrigeration, we have to base it on temperature.
That's
what
right.
temperature are we trying to maintain in the store in the cases? And most cases are have a slightly different temperature. Red meat is like 26, 27 degrees. Dairy is going to be like 35. Produce might be 37. We all know air conditioning is 41. And then frozen things like an ice maker or an ice storage bin might be 21 degrees. Frozen food is going to be zero. Ice cream is going to be about minus 10. So everything's different. So that's why there's all these different circuits that come off of the rack. But you want your rack, whether it's medium temp or low temp, you want the suction set point for whatever refrigerant is in that rack to be set for the lowest case necessary. Whatever your coldest case in the store is, whether it's on medium or low temp, that's the temperature that rack is going to be set for on suction set point. So say, for instance, let's think of a scenario here. Say you're using, excuse me for 1 minute here, but we still see, even though R22 is going away, well, I'll try to think of a different gas here. Let's say 407F. Okay, so we're going to use 407F just as a example. Now, let's say that our medium temp rack is a plus 25 degree rack. And we're going to use our scale on the dew point side for a 25 degree rack, plus 25 medium temp for 407F. We're going to want the suction set point to be 52 PSI. So the computer on the suction group is going to be set for 52 PSI all the time. So those compressors, all eight of those compressors, or however many of them are, their job is to all run in order to maintain 52 PSI. Now, if they fall higher or lower than that, some will cycle on and some will cycle off. And then that's why maybe one or two of those compressors have unloaders, so that they can, instead of always turning on and off, you're always keeping some load going or some capacity running. You just reduce it and then you have less cycles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's other concepts. There's a lot of other concepts, and maybe they're going to go over people's heads. I don't know. There might be some listening who get these things. But we have concepts called floating suction. And what that does is that takes that suction set point. And as we go into defrost, because as is necessary with refrigeration, we have to defrost these cases.
Yep.
Because most of these cases, even in medium temp, are going to be running lower than freezing, than 32 degrees.
That's right, yeah.
So our evaporators, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just agreeing with you. Yeah, I was saying, yeah, that's right. I was agreeing with you that they all have to be defrosted. Yeah.
So our evaporators are below 32 degrees. We're going to need defrost on pretty much everything. So as cases go into defrost, we can change our suction set point based on need. Maybe the lowest temp case that requires that we run the rack at 52 PSI goes into defrost. And maybe the next coldest case requires the suction set point to be at 54 PSI or even higher, maybe 56 PSI, based on the temperature, the PT relationship of that refrigerant. So that's what they call floating suction. Now the computer basically says the rack the coldest case is now in defrost. So we have an alternative case that we're going to use as our reference for suction set point.
Okay.
So now it floats the suction set point up. It floats it up a little bit. And as it floats the suction set point up, now we have a closer compression ratio on our compressors, and now we're using less energy. So that's one way that they're able to save energy in storage, is to float the suction up and down based on need. And they can do the same thing with the head pressure on the condenser. They can bring it as low as possible based on ambient conditions. The closer you can put the compression ratio together on any given compressor, you can greatly reduce the kilowatt hours on that compressor. So interesting things, but that's basically the purpose of the rack. There's a lot to it in the things I'm saying, but basically you're just trying to maintain a suction set point at all times. And you're just doing it with a lot more equipment than you would otherwise.
Okay, I got a couple of questions.
Yeah.
So
sure.
The first one, so we want to maintain the lowest possible suction for the cases. So let's say we have three different cases, three different temperatures, and the lowest case is satisfied, right? Or actually, let me rephrase that. So we have three different case temperatures, and we want to get down to that lowest one, but one of the cases at a higher temp, it's satisfied. So what do we do now? Do we close off a solenoid valve going out to that case so we no longer cool it? Like, how do we stop cooling that one that's satisfied, but we got to still maintain that lowest suction set point in running the compressors? How do we shut that case down to stop cooling? Is that through the solenoid valve?
Yeah, there's different ways of doing that, yes. And that's a good question. Very good question. On the rack, like I mentioned, there's a lot of different branch lines. So you're going to have, like any other system, you're going to have two pipes going out to that case. You're going to have a liquid line, and you're going to have a suction line coming back to the rack.
Yep.
So there's two different ways of controlling that case. The old school way, and probably a lot of guys out there will still see this on some of the older things, is a thermostat in the case and a liquid line solenoid valve either at the case or at the rack. So as that thermostat satisfies, then, of course, you shut the solenoid and you stop feeding refrigerant to the case.
Yep.
Or to a whole lineup of cases, depending. So that's the old school method. It's good, but it's not very accurate. And there's a couple different reasons, particularly if the solenoid valve is at the rack, because it can be a long distance from the rack to the case.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if you shut the solenoid, you're going to keep feeding the liquid for quite some time if you're, let's say, halfway across the store from the case. So the better way of doing that with that old school method is to have the solenoid in the case itself. Because then immediate shutoff.
Okay.
But the problem with that is liquid hammer. So we get liquid hammer as soon as we open that solenoid again, because the suction is always going to keep pulling back.
Yeah.
So once that liquid shuts and the rest of the rack is still running, it's a little different than in a single system where the compressor shuts down too. In this case, the compressors are still running. So once we open that liquid line again, well, we got liquid hammer a little bit. Sometimes you'll see those liquid lines jump as soon as that solenoid opens in the case. And you can cause cracks, you can get vibration, all kinds of problems in the case. So the newer method of doing it, which is much more accurate for many reasons, is to install what we call a suction stop. So a suction stop basically shuts the refrigeration off on the suction line instead of the liquid line. And it uses the suction stop basically to instantly stop the refrigerant flowing through the evaporator by the refrigerant leaving rather than entering. So we still have refrigerant in the evaporator, and we still even have vapor in the evaporator, but the distances from the rack will help counteract the if any of that recondenses to liquid. So not a big deal, not too big of a deal.
Is the suction
more accurate.
Is the suction stop like a solenoid valve though? Is it the same general idea? Okay.
Same general idea as a liquid line solenoid. It's just a solenoid that shuts the suction line. But now we get into a whole nother thing in refrigeration. So they've created dual purpose suction stop valves that also are suction stop EPRs. Now an EPR is an evaporator pressure regulator.
Yep.
Now this is really critical in refrigeration. So we already spoke about the fact that on a rack, we are trying to maintain a certain suction set point. However, we're maintaining the lowest suction set point necessary for the coldest case in the entire on the entire rack for that particular rack in that store. But on that rack and on that line of the cases, we're probably going to have cases that run much warmer than the coldest case. So how do we keep those cases from getting too cold? We use an EPR, an evaporator pressure regulator, and it can basically have a dual purpose as a suction stop and an evaporator pressure regulator. This is a valve on the suction side that can be throttled down and set so that it keeps the evaporator at a particular pressure higher than the pressure on the rest of the rack, slightly higher or much higher, depending on need. So as the example I used earlier on the gas 407F, we were looking at 52 PSI as being our rack pressure, and that would equivalate to 25 degrees. Well, let's say we have another case, like a fresh meat case on that rack, that has to be at 27 degrees. So that would constitute 55 PSI. So for that lineup of cases or that case, we can set the EPR to 55 PSI instead of the 52 PSI that the rack is running at. And that suction stop will keep, or that suction stop EPR will keep that particular evaporator running at a slightly higher pressure and higher temperature as required for that case. And yet it has the dual purpose of when defrost comes, it can also, when defrost comes or when the case satisfies, and actually it's more defrost, because an EPR isn't necessarily, let me see how to put this. An EPR kind of takes the place of a suction stop, even though they can be a dual purpose valve. If you have an EPR, it's going to maintain a constant temperature rather than having to open and close the refrigeration on that case. It just constitutes a constant pressure. So you don't necessarily have to always shut the case down with by shutting off a solenoid. There's a lot of different ways of doing this, but you can make it so that there's a liquid line and an EPR, a liquid line solenoid and an EPR and a suction stop. They can all be combined into one valve or a couple of valves. So it's kind of getting complicated, but these are just some of the different methods. But the EPR suction stop also acts as the means of defrost too. So when defrost comes, it closes the suction stops, EPR shuts the refrigeration off to the case and allows it to defrost. So the invention of those valves, the EPR valve suction stops, has really made case control so much more accurate and so much more efficient than the old method of liquid line solenoids.
Yeah,
it's just a much better way of doing it.
It does sound like a really cool way of doing it. And I was going to ask you, is it a mechanical valve or is it like a stepper motor controlled electronically?
Generally, it's electronic.
Okay.
They do make pilot versions of them that use pilot gas to do them, but generally they're electronic. The solenoids are all electronic.
Nice.
And Sporlan, I know Sporlan and Parker make a wide variety of those, depending on application. Some of them, and they do even make the step valve type now, that are completely electronic. And those step valves are great. I know those ones that Sporlan makes. And yes, they basically are the same thing. They open and shut for a suction stop, or they can be set at a particular step valve setting for EPR purposes. So yes, it just depends on the control method being used for that rack, whoever designs it. But yeah. They most of the time they're electronic.
Okay, so a couple more questions. So we've satisfied a couple zones or whatever, a couple cases, and we we're still running the one. So now that the suction stop closes, and because the two cases are satisfied, but we want to maintain the lowest suction, and that one's still running for that lowest case. Are we now unloading the compressors or staging the compressors off on the rack in order to so we're not having as much flow of refrigerant to these cases?
That, well, not necessarily. Not necessarily. It depends on it depends really on what the rest of the cases are doing. Generally, one case isn't going to affect the suction pressure on the rack that much.
Okay.
What is going to affect suction pressure on the rack is if we go into defrost. Not necessarily if the cases satisfy. Again, like I said, if the EPRs, if it's a store setup with EPRs, generally we're not going to have cases satisfying all that much. They're going to maintain most of the time because they're pretty dead on accurate, especially if we have step valves. Those EPRs are going to keep those cases dead on accurate most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But when we go into defrost, say we take out a whole lineup of cases, maybe five or six cases going to defrost at one time. Now we're going to have an effect on the rack.
Okay.
We're going to have, initially, we're going to have less load on the rack because obviously less cases are calling.
Yep.
So it might be much easier to maintain suction pressure at this point. So yeah, we're going to possibly cycle off a compressor or unload for a little while. However, then after we come out of defrost, now it's a whole different story. And we come out of defrost, and there's been time for the vapor and the evaporators to recondense the liquid. So we're going to get a pretty good chunk of liquid coming back to the rack at one time. So as we do that, that's going to affect a few things. And remember, it's going to be coming back initially through the suction lines. So it's going to raise suction pressure because the distances from the cases to the rack, to those compressors, there will be obviously time for the liquid to expand, mm-hmm. and most of it to turn to vapor.
Yep.
But we're going to definitely raise suction pressure as we come out of defrost. And so obviously now at the end of defrost, compressors are going to cycle on more. We're going to start loading compressors again. And yes, sometimes under certain circumstances, you even have to have crankcase pressure regulators on the compressors to keep them at a certain point so you don't overwork them at the end of defrost. That's not always the case on racks. That generally tends to be an issue more with single systems, having to put a crankcase pressure regulator on a compressor,
yep.
to protect it after defrost. But in this case, we usually don't have to do that on racks. But yeah, basically that's to answer your question. We don't necessarily have to cycle compressors on and off, or not have to, but that generally won't happen just as a few cases get to temperature.
Okay, gotcha. So
especially if it's a large store, and the load is spread out.
Yeah, exactly. So my other question was, how are we defrosting the cases? What method are we using for that?
There are several different methods. So let's talk first about medium temp. Medium temp, generally, we just have to off cycle. So that just constitutes, in however the method is, the old school method, shutting off the liquid line solenoid valves. The newer method, shutting the suction stops and basically interrupting the refrigeration to those evaporators on those cases. The fans generally will continue to run on medium temp cases, and it will pull ambient air across and naturally defrost those cases.
Yeah, so just an off-cycle defrost.
Off-cycle defrost.
Yeah.
And that's usually going to be 3 or 4 times a day, 35 minutes to 40 minutes,
mm-hmm.
Per cycle, generally. So it's usually about every 6 hours. Low temp is a different story, and there's different ways of doing it. I've been familiar with the two major ways of doing it, which is electric defrost or hot gas. So I prefer hot gas myself, but I haven't seen a lot of it in California myself. In Texas, we had a lot of hot gas defrost. In California, we primarily use electric defrost. So obviously low temp, you're going to have a lot of frost and ice accumulation. So you have to have a heat source. You definitely have to have a heat source to get the defrost necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Your fans are going to shut off on low temps. You're going to definitely turn the fans off because you don't want to circulate cold air because it's going to impede your ability to defrost properly.
And you don't want to shoot water out of the coil as it's defrosting off of it either.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you got issues. You got other issues.
Yeah.
You can create problems that way as well. Exactly. So hot gas. Now in a hot gas application on a rack, there's a couple different ways of doing that. There are two pipe and three pipe hot gas racks. So a three pipe hot gas rack, there's a separate pipe from the rack that goes out to the cases carrying the hot gas from the, so there's basically at the rack, you have your suction line and your liquid line, but at the suction line, well, actually, if this is a three pipe situation, off of the discharge, you have a separate solenoid that's just for hot gas. And it will go out to the racks and then at the rack, go out to the cases. And at the case, it'll basically enter the suction line after the suction stop, and it'll have its own solenoid. And basically, it sends hot gas through the system backwards. It sends it through the suction, and it comes and it basically starts the latent heat starts to basically change the condition of the vapor into a liquid in the evaporator, and you start to accumulate liquid back through the liquid line. And it will feed basically back to the rack, and the rack will have what they call a liquid line header or a defrost liquid line header that takes the liquid back. That's a three pipe. A two pipe is pretty much the same, except that the defrost solenoid or the hot gas solenoid is at the rack and enters the suction line at the rack. So it basically is again after the suction stop. And it has its own solenoid. So if the case goes into defrost, it'll shut the suction stop so that there's no ability for the suction to come back to the rack. It'll open the hot gas, and it'll discharge the hot gas into the suction line in reverse back to the case, going through the suction, and then returning through the liquid line back to the rack. And then there's a separate liquid line return header for that. So that's a much... I don't know if I want to say efficient. I prefer it because it's faster.
Mm-hmm.
Hot gas is much faster. And it's kind of cool because you got a lot of extra moving parts. You know, you got all the extra solenoids and the reverse flow. And sometimes you can actually watch it defrost because it's so fast. The pros and cons is that to perform hot gas defrost, you're obviously using compressor kilowatt hours because you're basically stealing your own discharge from the rack.
Yes.
As opposed to electric defrost, you have to have a separate power source. And of course, electric heaters use an enormous amount of energy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's weighing the cost as to which one basically is going to require more kilowatt hours. Do you want those kilowatt hours to come from your compressors, or do you want them to come from an external electric source? But there's different ways of doing it. Like I said, in California, we generally don't have hot gas defrost here very much. But
I don't do tons and tons of refrigeration, but all the stuff I take care of, it's all electric. It is a very slow process because, I mean, after a while, they expand and contract, and they don't sit properly anymore. They might be the clearance gets bigger and bigger after a while, I notice. But if you're running hot gas right through that coil, I mean, that coil's right in it's actually touching that ice, so that ice is going to melt way quicker. So I get what you're saying. There is something I did want to ask. I guess depending on the size of the store, you could have tons and tons of cases, but you never see the piping. So, and I know talking to friends and stuff that are in the industry, like we're running this piping kind of in, we're digging out trenches and stuff, and then we're burying it. Is that how we do this? Do we bury the piping to go into all these racks, like with poured concrete?
There's actually a couple different ways of doing it. The newer way to do it is to run it all overhead.
Okay.
In the past, I dealt with a lot of stores in the past where, yeah, they, when they're pouring the foundation, it's all trenched. So we have either trenches or tunnels under the floor. There's a few stores I saw that literally had a 2 or 3 foot diameter tunnel on, about four feet down, that there was a pit in the back of the store that you could actually enter it, and you could actually get in the tunnel with the piping and follow it if you had to, in case you had a leak in there. But yeah, the old school way was to trench it out, put all your piping underground, and then take it to the back and then bring it up to the mechanical room or the motor room. But more and more these days, I see it run overhead. So okay, they'll build a chase from, especially from the center of the store, if that's where your frozen food cases are, and they'll have it come down from overhead support structure. And, okay. So there's different ways of doing it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Because that was my question. Like, for some reason, I was under the impression that if they're running under the floor in these trenches, that we may have some spots. If we have a leak, we're not going to be able to get to that section of piping. Like, is that ever the case?
Yes.
Or, okay.
Yeah, we had a case in Texas where it was a store with an underground tunnel under the floor. It was about a 2 foot diameter tunnel. You couldn't get in it because there was too much piping in the tunnel.
Yep.
And we had a leak. It was the tunnel came at an angle from one corner of the store under the floor out to the frozen food cases, and then under the cases there was a hatch in the aisle right by the glass doors, and you could pull the hatch up, and you could actually look down and see under the case where the piping all came up from underneath. But we had one line up of frozen food cases, and it had a pretty severe leak on the liquid line, but it was back in far enough where we couldn't get to it from the pit that was by the cases. It was too far in to reach and buried with all the other piping. But we could get to the other end of the tunnel in the back of the store where the pit was. You could actually stand at the other end of it, probably about 3 or 4 feet below ground level, and you could look down the tunnel, and you know, 30, 40, 50 feet, well, probably 50 or 60 feet down there, you could see at the other end, you could see the other technician with his head sticking down in the floor.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Believe me, I got some stories. This is some interesting stuff. It's crazy what we've had to do. But we had to get that thing repaired, but we couldn't reach the leak. So what we did, the piping wasn't completely cracked. It just had a hole in it. So what we did is we abandoned that line. We took the one end that we could reach going into the case, and we cut it. Well, we took soft copper, because stores generally, you're going to use all hard copper. But we didn't have that option in the store. So we went and purchased several rolls of half-inch soft copper, and we welded, or we brazed onto one end of where we had cut at the case. And we had two techs down there, and we had the other tech at the other end in the pit, and cut the other end of the pipe that was still good, and started pulling it out. And I was that tech in the pit. As I'm pulling the pipe, the new pipe at the other end is already brazed to the other end, is being fed through. So we basically, using the bad pipe, we fished the new half inch line through the tunnel from one end to the other.
Yeah.
And then when we got it through, we brazed it on each end, and we were good.
That's brilliant.
So
yeah,
it was one way we had to do it, but it worked in the long run. It worked. So
amazing.
So yeah, it's one of the drawbacks of having trenches under the store. Definitely.
So I guess the drawback of having it run through the above is that some of these stores are going to have some high ceilings, right? So you'd have to bring in like a scissor lift or something like that, or a genie boom to get up to these ceilings to find some of these leaks, wouldn't you?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. We've had to do that with pretty much, most of them are too tall to get with a ladder. So yeah, you got to be up on a scissor lift. And then also the other issue with overhead piping is leakage, because especially on low temp, generally the center of the store is your low temp cases, and that's where most of your overhead piping is going to. So your rubber insulation, your, whatever we call it, Armaflex, Rubitex, you got to make sure it's really well insulated. It's really well taped, all the seams. And then after time, no matter how well insulated it is, the insulation will saturate with water.
Mm-hmm.
And especially after many cycles of freezing the pipe and then defrosting and freezing and defrosting, you'll start to get that stuff rubbing, either wearing through, and then you'll be walking through the store and all of a sudden you'll get a nice cold drip of water on your head. No matter who you are, you look up and it's time to reinsulate the piping. And some of these stores let it go way too long, and then it starts raining on the customers. So that's where our piping guys come in, and some of those guys are really amazing because they got to know all, they're really good at cutting all the angles too, and knowing how to cut all the pipe. It's just cut the insulation at just the right angle on elbows, long radius, how to glue and tape and all that, make it look good, make sure it's well supported. Got to give them credit because it's not fun work, especially when that stuff's saturated. It's really heavy and it's really gross.
Yeah.
So,
well,
professional
insulators do a really good job.
They do. I've had to help them before, and I don't envy what they do, but I certainly admire it.
Yeah, no, they do. We've had professional insulators come out on a few of our jobs, and it just makes everything look so nice and so fresh when they're finished with it.
Indeed. Indeed.
Well, you know what? We were actually going to have a two-part conversation. We were going to talk about high-rise chiller plants and whatnot, but we seem to have had a good long conversation on supermarket refrigeration, so we might have to do this again, Mario.
Absolutely. I'm fine with that. I'm game.
We'll have to have a part two on some high-rise building stuff, but you did provide... You provided so much good info during that conversation. And you taught me a bunch of stuff that I didn't know, so I really appreciate that.
No problem. You got it. It's for me, it's a joy to talk about it. It's interesting. I like to share what I know.
Oh, I can feel your passion just ringing through as you're talking about it. So, what I think we should do is we'll let the listeners go, and you and I can have a chat. We'll say bye. As we normally do. So thanks, guys. Mario, thank you very much for getting onto the podcast, and I hope you guys enjoyed listening.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it, Gary.
Yeah, no problem, man.
All right, so what I take from that conversation is this. Supermarket refrigeration is going to challenge you. And if you like a challenge, that might be the part of the industry where you can kind of flourish. I mean, you're going to have to put the time in, obviously, because as we discussed, things need to be up and running kind of ASAP, like yesterday. So if you're out on a job, I mean, sometimes you ain't going home. That's just the way it is. If you're on call, you might be gone all weekend. If you're on call, you might get a call at 8 a.m. and not be home till 2 a.m. It's just the way it is. It's how the industry kind of rolls, and that part of it. So Mario, thank you so much for getting onto the podcast. I appreciate it, and the listeners do as well, or they wouldn't be listening to you, and they wouldn't be getting this far into the podcast. So for me, supermarket refrigeration is going to challenge you mentally because there's so many moving parts, and if you like that kind of thing, it might be the thing for you to do. All right. And I'm sure there's tons of work out there in that part of the industry. I'm sure there's tons of it because there's a lot of supermarkets around. Nobody stops going shopping. Everything needs to stay running. Okay. I'm out, guys. That's the podcast. Happy HVACing.